Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 441. I am your host, James Jones. With me today is the abeyant, Mr. John Lindemann.
I obey.
That's not the word I use, but okay.
Obeyant?
Also with us is the able, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Yeah, we're still on the air. We're still doing this. It's impressive.
It is impressive. And then, lastly, is the abstruse, Mr. Greg Leahy.
Well, this is the first time I've been called that, I think. Though I do interact with people very little.
Well, that's not the definition for it I was going for.
No.
I was like, what are we doing? Okay. Though I didn't mean for that to be negative. This has already gone wrong. All right, so for reference, I referred to myself as a Bulick, which I decided to drop because that actually is the most negative of the four. So
you're definitely a word that starts with A. Definitely.
Is there a word that starts with A that just means like making your life needlessly complicated?
Yes, I'm sure there is, and I have definitely just made my life needlessly complicated. So that probably is the last time we do that, because that's actually really hard. So, But you know, it's not the last time we're doing. This is not the last time we're doing new business. In fact, it's the 441st time we're doing new business, and I feel confident there'll be a 442nd. But apparently, for the first time in a long time, John's leading up this week.
I am leading off this week, and you know, that's I was surprised, because usually I'm the guy that's off to the side.
Well, John, why don't you just ahead and
playing some Nintendo stuff.
Why don't you just go ahead and flipper us into your new business?
Well, I'm talking about Destiny this week. Sorry, I'm kidding.
That's 441. Join us next week.
Anyways, yes. So I decided to do a little bit of perusing of the Wii U Virtual Console, because I hadn't actually looked at it for a little while, and there's always some gems there. Really, I was kind of drawn to it by 3D Gunstar Heroes. Which has nothing which is just kind of a separate thing, but I was sort of like, I should probably just check in general what's going on the Virtual Console. And of course, there's been some stuff released that I did own on the Wii, so they always suck me in with the discounts. So, but what they did suck me into buying was Pokemon Pinball Ruby and Sapphire for GBA. Now, I question my wisdom a little bit at paying $8 for a Game Boy Advance game, but
it's a valid concern.
I mean, I like pinball, and actually, I do own Pokemon Pinball somewhere. It's somewhere lurking in
the Game Boy Color
around
one.
Here. Yeah, for the Game Boy Color, right? And I've never played this one, so I was very curious to see kind of, you know, what it was like, right? So, yeah, so I like it. It's very obviously geared towards kids because it's very forgiving.
What was your first hint, John?
maybe the fact that it's using the Pokemon, right? But yeah, I mean, it's not trying to be. And you know, I was trying to think back to Metroid Prime Pinball and just how difficult that game was. I can't remember if it was difficult or not.
I think this is definitely more forgiving, just in terms of the basics of how likely are you to lose your ball at a given moment. This is definitely more forgiving than that. I downloaded this months ago and played a fair bit of it, and I played Metroid Prime Pinball to death years ago, so I feel like I got a pretty good handle on them. And it makes sense in the context of the game because of the whole kind of you're kind of collecting the Pokemon, you're catching them. I'd think it might be frustrating for kids if every time you played it, you didn't like get anything, you didn't make any progress in that regard.
Yeah, they give you a lot of Pokemon to catch, and I mean, generally, even in the kind of the feel of the game, you kind of have to go a long way to actually lose your ball, right? Because it just seems like the flippers, they have a really kind of wide hitbox. So, I mean, sometimes I'll be like, you know, there's no way I'm going to get that ball. It's going to go through. And then I'll just, you know, so I'll just mash and sure enough, I'll hit it. So it's extremely, extremely forgiving in that sense. But, you know, there's plenty of like, you know, kind of neat stuff to do. You know, plenty of targets to hit. You know, you can get Pokemon to come out on the board and, you know, then you have to hit them 3 times or 5 times and, you know, spell the word catch. And then, you know, your little pinball, which is a Pokeball, you know, catches the Pokemon, and there's some, you know, some kind of extra boards that you can, you know, get spun off to, and the Pokemon change based on, you know, what area you're in. You can get like a travel option, and you can go to a different part of the Pokemon world, and of course the Pokemons change along with that depending on which ones would, you know, appear in that area in the Pokemon games.
So yeah, I think that the coolest thing about that idea of filling out the Pokédex in a pinball game is that you can, especially think about pinball games, high school games in general. Well, if you set a high score that's pretty high, then it's going to take quite a while to beat.
Yep.
It becomes less and less inviting to play it. But you've got this sort of meta objective with Pokemon Pinball, which is, well, maybe if I don't seriously challenge the high score, I might still work one of those regions a little more and capture a bunch of Pokemon and up before and fill out the Pokédex. So it's just something else there that could help draw you back to it right when the score becomes a bit more intimidating.
Yeah,
right.
Well, I mean, it's not hard to get a huge score, though. I mean, right now, I think the game I have going, of course, you can use save states, which can completely...
I'm not save stating it.
I'm using this.
You can use save states, not that I'm doing that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can, of course. You know, I mean, I'm above that.
Let me give you a
serious gamer,
save states.
As has been established years ago.
A serious pinball player.
Serious pinball player. I think the score I have on there right now for the game, I mean, I played the game for like a half an hour and I had the same game going for a half an hour. I'm just like, I just don't feel like playing this. I don't want to just, lose, but I was just like, I'm just going to save state this and come back to it.
It is nice that you could just suspend the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, just even if it was just that kind of like old Wii Virtual Console rules, that is helpful because... like I said, compared to some pinball games, individual goes can go on for a while.
Yeah, I mean, right now my score is at like 162 million, which that's the thing. That sounds like a lot, but it's very easy to rack up points. It just
seems I can't remember where my scores got to, but it all kind of leads up to catching. Like it depends which table, because you've got the ruby table, the sapphire table.
Yep.
So
yep.
You've got Groudon, for instance. Like you'll be able to catch him, and then I think you can catch Rayquaza after that. And
yeah, then you can evolve them as well.
You could evolve the ones that you've caught, like the regular Pokemon. You can evolve those. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much kind of extra stuff to do.
Yeah, shop the Pokemart. You can do that too.
So it's not just kind of ruthlessly going for the score. You could just see different things. See what happens with those. But yeah, you get to a point. Like I said, I got to a point where I caught Rayquaza like three times or something.
The one of a kind Rayquaza.
This is going on forever.
Yeah. Yeah, it does go on forever.
Did that game have vibration in it, like the Game Boy Color game?
Yeah,
did?
It's permanently turned off, but it's there in the option menu, but it's just grayed out and you can't get to it.
Oh,
so
that's
one of the things I looked at. I was like, this had Rumble, didn't it? And I'm like, son of a bitch. I wanted it that, of course,
that'd
I mean, they can't
cool.
do anything. It doesn't have any Rumble on the gamepad, but yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, is it $8 good? I don't know. I kind of have
it's potentially a game that you could keep going back to, so...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's kind of why I wanted it. I mean, it's the only pinball game that I have.
You can get NES pinball on the Virtual Console.
Can you really? Is it on there?
Yeah.
For Wii U?
Yeah, it is, but it's not very good. But
no,
there is
NES pinball!
There is Zen pinball, though, if you want, Star Wars tables
and
whatever, Marvel.
Yeah.
True.
You've got some original stuff on there as well. It's as video gamey as... Pokemon is really.
Yeah, I mean, video game pinball and real world pinball have somewhat evolved into being kind of different things because you can do so much more in a video game, obviously. You can't have the entire
table
change.
Well, and then you get the sort of situation where, like, with Pinball Arcade, that game that kind of spun out of the Pinball Hall of Fame collections and stuff, that is trying to precisely replicate real pinball as a video game. So you've got the two different schools of pinball represented as video games at this point.
Yeah.
And certainly the more realistic ones generally tend to be a lot less forgiving just in terms of can you keep your ball going? Because with the video game, the ones that stress the video game medium, they will add loads more objectives and all this kind of stuff. And that's, to make that stuff kind of appealing, I think you have to be able to kind of just survive more.
Right.
You know, so that's what leads it down that path.
Well, and because they work under a very different economic proposition. Video game pinball, they got your money already. They needed to make that initial offering.
Whereas, yeah, the old coin munching sort of went back into the old school pinball. Although, as time went on, they kind of competed with each other for flashiness as well. Like, if you play one of those collections, you get to kind of see how different they got over throughout the 80s and 90s.
There was a barcade in LA last year that we went to for a pre-E3 event for indie games. I can't remember what it was called, but they had a pinball machine there for like the second Addams Family movie. Mm-hmm. That, in terms of just complete visual idiocy, is on par with anything that you would see in a video game pinball. Yeah.
Well, certainly there's an Addams Family table that was kickstarted for the pinball arcade.
Really?
Game. Yeah, they got to get the license and to get that, because that's something they've done quite a lot. T2 as well, you know, cause there's extra sort of fees involved, I guess, with the license stuff.
I wonder if that's the one then.
The table that was kickstarted is very well regarded amongst the pinball community as a kind of a very memorable table.
I dumped about $2 into it that night, which is like 8 plays. Just kept going.
Yeah, it's really fun though. I mean, if you just want to kind of turn your brain off and just sort of react to stuff, it's really cool.
It is a bit slow as well, isn't it, John? Because I mean, the fact that you've got a really limited field of view, as you might expect on the GBA, it isn't exactly perfect for pinball because it's very low resolution, the aspect ratio. I mean, there's not much about it that's apt for it.
Yeah, it does look really good on the gamepad, though. I mean, every time I play one of these games on the gamepad, I'm like, man, the gamepad is pretty much the best Nintendo thing ever for playing these older games. It's perfect. And, you know, it's interesting, too, moving from kind of like as you move from platform to platform, I'm always curious to see how these games present themselves. Like this one, it actually scrolls it scrolls up and down with you, you know, as your ball goes up and down. Whereas, like, I think the original Pokemon Pinball, I think it flipped back and forth, if I remember correctly.
I mean, I've not played that, but I have played like Kirby's Pinball Land on Game Boy, which had discrete screens that it would go between. I mean, that's kind of a classic sort of separation. Like Alien Crush had two screens, whereas Devil's Crush scrolled. You know, like that's kind of, there's pros and cons. You know, because I think judging angles is easier when it's fixed.
Yeah.
Right.
But the scrolling kind of, you know, prevents that really jarring discontinuity when the ball goes from one screen to the other. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a bit pick your poison. Like I said, I mean, when you're scrolling and it's got this tight field of view, the slow pace of Pokemon Pinball is probably a good fit for those limitations.
Well, I would imagine that on the Game Boy Color, that game actually was fairly kinetic for a Game Boy Color game, so it may not have been capable of doing the scrolling. Sort of like the Sharp 6800 port of Mario Brothers, where it just
screen by screen, load, next screen, load. MSX Vampire Killer, the alternate version of the first Castlevania, it was a screen by screen game.
Yep.
And speaking of.
Speaking of Castle, that was a good segue. the other game that I played, one of the games I've had, pretty much every game is like, I've had it for a while and I haven't really played it very much. Castlevania 3 Dracula's Curse. So I had that on the Wii, and I remember, I think I actually did talk about it, but I probably just talked about it very briefly and I never really dug into it. So I dug into it a little bit.
I think apart from James, I think we all kind of took turns talking about that when it came out.
Yeah. And I just didn't talk about it because you guys had already handled it.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually surprised. The thing is, in my mind, I had this impression that it was more like 4, where it was kind of more arcadey. Yeah. You had the branching paths and stuff. But I started playing it, and I mean, I got through to, I think I played through about 3 areas. Like, I beat the very first area, then I beat the clock tower, then you kind of double back after you get Grant, or whatever his name is, the thief.
Yeah.
And so that's where I'm at now, and I was just like, wow, this really is the first game, just longer. I mean, it plays exactly the same as the first one, and I always thought like it was some quantum leap beyond the first game, but it plays exactly like the first game.
You've got the other characters, though. Want it to play more differently, have that option.
Yep.
And it is way bigger. That is the other thing. You know, when you've got all the alternate levels and paths and bosses and, it's, especially the way they kind of chop it up in the, I think the entrance to the castle is like level 10 or 9 or something. They kind of backload it that way to make it feel even bigger. But the castle at the end obviously isn't as big as the first one. But
it's the first game extended. It's taken to its, complete extent. It's as far as it can go, pretty much, with that concept, I think.
It's kind of, they didn't do that with Castlevania 2. Obviously, that was Simon's Quest. That was very different. And this is the kind of thing that happened a lot in the NES era. Is like the second one, you experiment a bit. The third one, you go bigger, better, badder. Like that was the cycle for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Zelda being the obvious other example.
Except the third one was on the Super Nintendo, so it had that aspect to it as well.
Yeah. I mean, for me too, it's like I always wonder, kind of like I have these weird gaps in series that I otherwise really like. I mean, like, I've played on, I played all of the Castlevania games on the Game Boy Advance. I played all of those. And typically, like, up until the series just started, like, branching into, like, you know, whatever, Lords of Shadow and stuff
Pachi
like
slots?
That.
Pachislots? Oh.
Yeah, or like, you know,
<That's now.
laughs> all the terrible, yeah, exactly, like, all, yeah, exactly, all, or yeah, like, all of the terrible N64 stuff. You know, that's kind of where it fell off.
That you've jumped quite a bit farther back in time.
You skipped the best Castlevania ever with that conversation, John. Thanks.
Rondo of Blood is really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
But I mean, that's the thing. It's like there's Castlevania 3 is definitely a gap. Like I was probably just playing something extremely, like I was probably just playing some other huge game really heavily at the time, and I just wasn't interested in it. So.
No, it was a big gap for me because, you know, it was a late NES game and we'd already moved on to importing Super Famicom stuff at that point. So I never got to play it kind of contemporaneously. I loved playing 4 and, you know, I kind of went from there. But you know, when I did come back to it, you know, as a fan of as a humongous fan of the first one, I do like what it does with, you know, expanding on it. But there's lots of good stuff in it, but because it's so kind of big, there's also some flab in it, which you don't get in the first Castlevania. First Castlevania is very lean,
it's very well designed. It's an arcade
game. Even though it had a save in Japan because it was on the Famicom disk system, but yeah, it felt more of an arcade discipline. Thankfully, not too similar to Haunted Castle though. But the third one embraced the console-ness a little more. But you know, like I said, there's bits of it that just kind of, I don't know whether it's so much padding or it's just bad. Like, you know, there's a part where you just have to wait for the blocks to fill up. When you this very slowly ascending pile of bricks, I mean, that is really bad. I still don't understand how that got through.
They made an entire game of that in its predecessor, so I would assume that's how it got through.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there's some jumping stuff where I'm like, why are you really, like, the jumping in this game is terrible. Why are you having me jump on a swinging clock pendulum?
Again, they made an entire game of that stuff in its predecessor. Yeah. I would assume that's how it got through.
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
I like that the worst parts of 3 are essentially all of 2.
Yep. Yeah, it's been interesting kind of going back, just seeing it through the lens of history, so to speak.
It's got great music, even though it's a bit compromised in the Western version. It's still awesome, and some cool bosses, and some of the better 8-bit graphics that you'll see. So there is a lot to like there if you're a classic Castlevania fan. But a lot of people struggle with the platforming, as kind of John alluded to. You've got to have a pretty good tolerance for that kind of stiff. I think it's mostly fair, but it is a bit, you know, unforgiving.
I mean, they'll do stuff like there's the one area like right after the clock tower. You have to actually double back and go all the way back to the beginning of the clock tower to get out of it. But to do that, I had to laugh because, you know, you're going down these stairways that are just fucking interminable in this game. It's like, right, another fucking stairway. Hope I don't fall off.
It's
and so
no
so,
series so, has made stairs such a vital
yeah.
enemy.
Well, and so what I did was, you know, it's like stairway. It's this stairway going all the way down the screen. So I'm like, well, what if I just walk off? Would I go all the way down to the bottom? And it's like, no, of course, what they did is at the very bottom, they have a hole in the wall for no reason other than the fact to troll you if you happen to walk off because you hated going down the stairways. So you just walk off.
Yeah, I'm not fair.
I mean, it's a weird sequence that because it's kind of story driven, I guess. Like, it's like, oh, I'm going to be able to, like, take a shortcut to the castle. Mm-hmm. But then the clock that you find the clock tower starts crumbling and it's like, oh, no, you're not.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, it could have just had you not play that, to be honest. Yeah. We could have just assumed that, again, like, that's another part, a bit like the rising pile of bricks that I just don't think, you know, it's kind of, there was obviously an idea there and maybe they had something better in mind, but what came of it was not all that valuable because a game like this where it's precise and demanding and all that, I think more focus is better, to be honest. As nice as it is for games to be long and, you know, all that kind of stuff, I think it's better to keep it focused when it's a game that demands so much of the player myself. And this is a bit, he tries a bit too hard sometimes to be big and grandiose and all
that. Yeah, I mean, they threw everything into it.
Except everything that they put in 4, i.e. the good game.
Well, I mean, I love 4, but it's so, so much more forgiving when you
can
that's
why it's the good game.
Yeah, it is. It is.
That's what
I mean,
makes
it
the good one.
I think Rondo Blood does a very good job of working around the fact that you can't whip in every direction. That is very well designed around the fact that you have the limited moveset.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely the best sort of exponent of that classic style.
Yeah.
And then 4 is more inviting because it opens things up, but it is easier and sort of less focused as a result.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, like loving 4 like I do. It's kind of hard going back to 3 and just, I'm just like, this is the only, like, my whip only upgrades this much? I mean, come on.
The saddest thing about 4 is that they really...
Let's not get into 4. Like
the... No, I just want to say the saddest thing about it is that they never followed it up, like, with something that would have carried that gameplay style on. You know, we got a whole bunch of games that did the gameplay style of the first Castlevania, got a whole bunch of Castlevania games that did the style of Symphony of the Night. But 4...
And
which
2.
Is a little bit
and
of its
2.
Own thing, you know. Didn't get that treatment. That's
nope.
Always
well, I learned that 4 was made by people who went on to become Treasure. So maybe that explains it. Like
a little bit, but still, they could have incorporated the ideas a little more. But...
Oh well. Speaking of, not of nothing. Actually, that's not a bad transition because I forgot who was next. So
speaking of the treasure that we have coming up on the next,
there,
the
you
next
know what?
Versus
speaking
games,
of treasures, there, nailed it, nailed it.
Oh yeah!
So
the Namco Bandai.
After the, I went back to Uncharted Waters: New Horizon because I don't understand. I don't understand who I am anymore. And after the just plotting nature of that game, and actually completing one of the scenarios, but it took forever. I decided that I needed to change things up and get some action going. I went and downloaded the PS3 game, Ace Combat Infinity, which is a free-to-play game made by Bandai Namco. But I decided that I wanted to go ahead and try it because, like I said, speaking of treasure, Bandai Namco has a Wii U free-to-play game called Project Treasure coming out, which is apparently produced by Mr. Katsuhiro Harada. All we've seen of this game at this point is some third-person action characters running through fairly generic-looking rooms killing things. But even then, it's super, super small amount of footage. We've really seen more footage of people's eyeballs than we have of gameplay at this point, which is what makes this game so appealing to me personally. I don't think we know anything about when it's coming out, or really what it is, or how the free-to-play mechanics work, but I figured, let's take a look at another console free-to-play game that this company has made, in a series that I actually have a lot of history with and really, really enjoy. And so I downloaded this free-to-play Ace Combat game, which is much more heavily focused on multiplayer than previous games of the series, but it does have a full single-player campaign. And wow, it's super exploitive. I'll just come around and say, this is terrible. So you get 3, as they call them, barrels of fuel, which is the maximum amount of plays you can save up from just time, i.e. not buying them. And that takes about 4 hours, I think, to get them back. And you could probably clear through them in 10 minutes. So if you want to play for more than that, better drop some cash, son. But I was primarily doing the single player.
That really seems like a poor fit on PS3.
It feels like a poor fit on PS3.
I mean, you know, it's still kind of cheap and kind of sleazy on mobile or portable, whatever. But on PS3, it just seems counterproductive.
Yeah, so the single player campaign, you get the first two chapters free. You still burn fuel on them. But I say you get the chapters free, but you still have to use fuel because there's a whole second currency which you earn in-game called coins. And you get those from completing missions or playing in the multiplayer. So in the missions that you play in the game, you get about 200 coins each for clearing the mission. You start with 80,000 for whatever reason. Coins are used to upgrade your airplane, buy special weapons, buy new airplanes. There's a currency system very similar in previous Ace Combat games, but in those games, it's based on your performance, not just kind of like a, here's 200 coins for completing the chapter. But you also use coins to buy the subsequent chapters after 2 in the single player. So 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And the first chapter you buy, chapter 3, costs 200,000 coins. You get 80,000 to start with. Which means you will have to play those chapters somewhere in the neighborhood of hundreds of times to unlock chapter 3.
Oh, which presumably would cost a whole lot of a bunch of barrels.
Yes.
So you're either going to do it over a very gradual period of time, or you're going to have to pony up.
And every chapter costs an order of magnitude of 100,000 more than the previous chapter. Which is just fantastic. So really what they're telling you here is you should buy the $14 pack, which just unlocks all the chapters and gives you unlimited barrels to play the single player. Okay, that might be the way I have to go here. But I figured, let's try the multiplayer, because the game's constantly trying to prod you into multiplayer. And I was like, maybe I can earn more coins there. Maybe I won't just get 200 coins. So I go to play the multiplayer, and I go into a room, and immediately I'm met by a voice, somebody going, "Hey!" like really excited. And then I look and see that there's only two of us in the room. And I'm thinking, oh no. And I did quick play, like, get me in a match as fast as possible, and I just let it sit. I went to the kitchen, made a sandwich, and came back, and it was still just the two of us.
Oh my God. Which
leads me to believe his excited voice was because he probably hadn't seen another human being in weeks.
Just been talking to his volleyball the rest of the time.
So I actually felt bad when I left the room, but I realized, like, we were never going to start that match. Never, ever. So the multiplayer is just gone. Like this, they killed this poor game by making it free to play. It's amazing. I mean, because if you're saying, "Hey, I'll get the single player component of an Ace Combat game for $14," that's great. I've played 5 of those things. I love those games. But the opening 2 chapters of this game, like the one thing about that series since it made the turn to being the Metal Gear Solid of the air, and just being like dumb, stupid, ridiculous idiocy, and which is why I love it, by the way. It is that those first 2 chapters have to hook. Like, they have to be big, stupid, Independence Day-style productions. And the first 2 are just like, all right, now we're going to fly in a straight line. Now we're going to shoot down these airplanes that aren't fighting you. It's like...
it's a Monster Hunter demo.
What makes you think I want to pay for more of this? This is terrible. So, I mean, I really have to award Bandai Namco, Bandai... whatever order they're in now, I really have to give them credit for creating the least appealing free to play proposition I've ever seen. So let's hope they learned a lot of lessons on Project Treasure.
I'm guessing the progression probably isn't aimed at experienced, Ace Combat players. You know, maybe they're thinking, oh well, they'll pay the $40 up front and just drill into it. Do whatever they have to. But other people, we need to kind of lead them very slowly by the hand and all that. But again, it's just like that kind of design on a console. I'm still not really seeing it.
And for that kind of game too, because it's. I know that game is sort of viewed as like shooty bangs, explosions, auto fire, the extreme edition. But like I played Ace Combat 6 when it was still fairly new, Fire's Liberation, and like the online for that game got really intense. Like they're really high skill ceiling players in that game. But like in this, the multiplayer apparently isn't even operational because I mean I couldn't get into a match after a significant amount of time, but. Even if it were, I don't know how you could build up that skill set if the only way to do it is either wait, pay, or do these challenges that let you earn additional, what they call reserve barrels. But even then, you're not going to be able to get enough reps to get good, to get that good. So it seems like it's just a really bad choice for a free-to-play game. Like, I see where they were coming from.
Somehow I doubt that that Treasure Project thing is going to have a lot of depth in gameplay.
No.
So maybe that's not going to be a problem.
I at least held out more hope when it's from scratch.
Yeah.
When you're kind of trying to impose this structure a little clumsily on an existing template, I think it's apt for more trouble.
Yeah, I'm still curious about that game, but primarily now just because Harada's involved, and this is the man who brought us Tekken Ball. So, like, to a certain extent, I'm willing to give him some leeway, because at one point, John Gee and I were watching a bunch of martial artists play volleyball in front of a high school while singing about cheeseburgers and fries. So, I mean, it's like, I don't know, you're a crazy person, and made a Snoop Dogg level, because sure, why not?
On the subject of Nintendo Free to Start, have you heard about what's going on with the next Fatal Frame game in Europe?
I have not.
So they are going two ways with that. They are having a sort of the physical version is a limited edition, some fairly extraneous sort of things packed in with it. You know, for the
it comes
the
with free ghosts.
So people that want to buy a physical copy, something, you know, nice for them. But then the digital version is a free to start game.
Huh.
Where, you know, I don't know whether it's the first so many chapters or one chapter, and then presumably after that, I don't know whether it's like you have to pay for all of the rest of the game or it's gradual. But, of course, it was not sold that way in Japan. So, you know, the game presumably was not designed with any such structure in mind. So, yeah, I'd be kind of interested how that goes. But I guess, you know, maybe they're looking at the game. I mean, we had the Fatal Frame 2 remake on Wii over here, which did not make it to the States.
No, it did not. Depressingly.
And, you know, I assume that disappeared without a trace sales-wise. So I don't know whether it's in response to that or what, you know, this kind of experiment. But it'd be interesting to see how it pans out.
Yeah, I mean, if it's really just an attempt to really introduce that game to essentially to an audience that has no history with it, I can see that potentially being a way to do it, but I guess really it just takes the form of a demo at that point. It's just
it's kind of a when they say free to start, oftentimes that is kind of what it is.
Are they calling it Project Zero?
Yeah, it's still Project Zero here as opposed to Fatal Frame.
That's weird. Is there some reason for this that we know of?
Isn't that what its original name is in Japan?
I think it's just Zero, isn't it? Isn't it like Zero Butterfly or something like that?
I forget. It's definitely they're trying to be more faithful to the Japanese. You know, it's like those things where, you know, where we had Dr. Mario Express in America.
Oh, that's right.
We had a little bit of Dr. Mario because that's more faithful to Choto Dr. Mario in Japan.
It is a little bit more faithful to Choto.
Penta Tentacles.
Oh, that one just sounds like something from DeviantArt. So on that note, we're going to roll up to the next...
Deviant?
I didn't want to go there. The next artist, because there is an artist in this game.
Yeah, Greg, well, there is, got? Yeah. But I've got Kirby 64. Although, before I get on to that, first of all, I have to mention Picross 3D 2 is happening.
It is.
It is.
In Japan.
Yes. There is much rejoicing at that.
Yeah, they are. Who isn't excited about that? I mean, that's awesome. It's been a while. I kind of wondered whether, if and when it would happen, it would be... Oh, let me just swallow this down. Picross 3D E,
oh.
Or possibly Picross E 3D, because that's kind of what they've been doing on the eShop with the regular Picross games.
Right, but that's Jupiter, right? I don't think that Jupiter made Picross 3D. I think that HAL did.
Yes. No, they did. That is correct. But on DS, Jupiter made one sort of big Picross DS game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it's kind of got serialized.
Yeah,
3DS.
Right. But they're publishing it themselves, like the E series. That's their thing.
Yeah,
Nintendo's
not really
involved.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that has anything to do with Nintendo's decision, but it's just kind of, you know, they may think. I think it's born out of the thinking that it's kind of like, well, people are more apt to buy, like, a, you know, make it a lower sort of price of entry and people will buy a little collection rather than, oh, you know, I don't want to buy all these puzzles because I'll never play them, or there's like 300 or something, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that it's one big package myself, because certainly I got a hell of a lot of use out of Picross 3D on DS. And I mean, the thing about it is, it got a hell of a lot of use, despite the fact that, you know, it is so perfect as a digital game, but obviously we didn't have that yet on DS.
Right.
You know, because it's the kind of game that you're going to get sort of tempted to swap out for other stuff when you've got other stuff to play. Right. It's a lot nicer to have it just always there on the system, come in at any time you like and do a puzzle. It's going to be fantastic on 3DS. So I definitely wanted to express my rejoicing for that before we move on. And then the other thing is, earlier today I did download 3D Gunstar Heroes, which John kind of mentioned a little bit at the start there. And I don't have much to say about it yet, because I already just played the first level, except it does look very nice. Spoiler alert, M2 did a good job.
Excellent. I love those. Those games are amazing. Those things are
I am a sucker for the 3D classics.
Oh, I love them.
I've got almost all of them. Altered Beast, obviously not.
Oh, yeah.
And like a few others, but yeah, I really do like them, and I'll be talking about that next week, I can assure you. But to get on to Kirby 64, so I think the first thing I should probably say about this is just that I have been a very, very gradual convert to Kirby. Mm-hmm. The first Kirby game I ever owned was Canvas Curse. And that wasn't even really traditional Kirby. So it took me a long time to get to this point. But, you know, it kind of started, playing Kirby Fun Pack, as it's known over here, for the Kirby Super. What's it called again in America? Sorry, the
Superstar.
Superstar.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, which came out as Superstar Ultra on DS and all that. Mm-hmm. Kind of started with that on Wii Virtual Console for me, but then still didn't really fall all the way in love with it. I played Dream Land 2 on the Game Boy Virtual Console, which
it's
I quite
not a good
enjoyed.
Game. Oh, really?
I quite enjoyed it. I did quite enjoy it, but it's not that substantial. You know, it's kind of like it didn't really challenge any of my preconceptions about traditional Kirby. Mm. You know, it was slow, it was really easy, but it was pleasant, and, you know, when you pay £3 for it or whatever, I was happy with it, and I enjoyed my time with it, but it didn't change the way I felt about traditional Kirby. And really, kind of like, the first time I felt more like Kirby could be something I'd enjoy playing more of the games in the series, it was Kirby's Adventure, which was a 30p game back when they were doing that, you know, well, 30 cents, 30 yen, you know, for the 30th anniversary of the Famicom, back in 2013, I guess it would have been.
Sure.
So, yeah, I picked that up, and the thing I liked about that compared to other Kirby games that I played, other traditional ones, was the fact that it's faster and Kirby's smaller relative to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it just, I don't know, it feels more open, felt more kind of... had a decent pace to it. Everything just felt a little bit better. And so then I tried the Wii game, which obviously has plenty of tie-ins to
Return to Dreamland.
Yeah, Return to Dreamland or Kirby's Adventure Wii in Europe. Mm. For some reason, Kirby games can't be called the same thing over here. Until Triple Deluxe, they just didn't bother.
They just gave up.
They didn't bother convoluting that one. But yeah, so I played the Wii game, and I really enjoyed that one. And so I was all on board for Triple Deluxe. And now I'm kind of doubling back again to sort of some of the back catalogue of Kirby stuff to see, you know, how much I can enjoy there. I've got to like the series more. The thing about Kirby 64 is that it is more in that kind of Dreamland 2 mould. You might recall from now playing, now and again, it does actually do what it's supposed to. John and Joe's talking about Neil's article on the site about the trilogy of games. directed by Shimomura at HAL, when Sakurai didn't feel like doing a straight out Kirby sequel, and he was messing around with Air Ride and Smash Brothers, and you know, he didn't really want to do it, so it was left to other people to do it. So you get Dreamland 2, Dreamland 3, and Kirby 64. And so, yeah, it's in that more kind of slow mold of Kirby I'm not a huge fan of. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I beat the final boss today. I haven't got all the shards yet. But, you know, I've obviously seen most of the game. I guess I don't know whether there's anything extra for getting all the shards. But, you know, I still managed to enjoy it. And more so probably than Dreamland 2. I still haven't played Dreamland 3. So, you know, I think obviously the famous thing about it, which people do like, not everyone, this isn't one of your preferred Kirby games, is it, Guillaume?
Oh, absolutely not.
No, I didn't think so. I don't know where I know that from, but I remember it from somewhere.
Well, there was kind of a fight at some point when someone said that Kirby's Adventure was the best one, and I was like, no way.
Kirby gets me swinging.
Kirby's Dreamland 2 sucks, Kirby 64 sucks, and anyway.
And that was the last episode of RFN.
Yep.
So, you know, I know, you know, Guillaume obviously is very amenable to Kirby in general, is not a huge fan, but this was on TYP's 15 games for N64's 15th anniversary thing that we did. Nearly 200 episodes ago or whatever. You know, Johnny has spoke sort of quite favourably of it as well on occasion in the past. So I was still interested to try it out on that basis. And really, the N64 Virtual Console on Wii U makes it a lot more appealing than in previous cases, because you do now have the ability to suspend the game, which you didn't have before. You know, you do now have customizable controls, and on especially for PAL people, this is important. They do sometimes, at least, use the American version, so you don't have the 50Hz compromise version. So that's a big change on the Wii U. That they're not perfect about it. There's some vexing examples where they still use the 50Hz because of like one line of French text or something. Super Metroid says hi. But, you know, the fact that you can get it in this kind of format now definitely made it more appealing than it was back on Wii. And, you know, I've played through it, and I think the power blending mechanic that everyone talks about is pretty fun. There's a great deal of fun experimenting in the first few worlds and seeing what comes out. And even like pretty deep into the game, I ended up doing combinations I hadn't done before. But, you know, I mean, some of them are very intuitive. Okay, well, I've got fire and I've got rock. So what do you think could happen? Well, he turns into a volcano and shoots fiery rocks. Like, that makes perfect sense. But then, say, for instance, you get ice and spark. It's like, oh, yeah, well, you're not really sure what's going to come out. And then Kirby turns into a fridge, which can spew out food and then heal you.
Of course.
You know, like, some of them are just like beautifully counterintuitive and really funny. The best one for me, though, is Darth Maul Kirby, a double-bladed lightsaber for
nice.
Kirby. It was the era. It came out like in 2000 or whatever. It was just after Phantom Menace.
Oh, God.
Double-bladed lightsabers were all the rage. And it's awesome. It's awesome carving people a bit with Kirby.
It really is. Like, the power combining in this game is really cool.
I like that idea a lot. You know, it and also you can, even like enemies that don't yield powers, you can kind of hoist them over your head and use them for stuff. Like, kind of like if you grab a flying enemy, you can kind of glide for a bit, or you can grab a lobster that'll just sort of slash at things above you, or a water enemy that shoots things. So it even goes beyond the power combining bit, but definitely that's the sort of the big selling point. And I guess the funny thing is, even though it's a lot of the things about it are in the mold of Kirby games that I like rather less than, say, for instance, Kirby's Return to Dreamland on Wii, the power combining aspect of the game gives you some of what you get out of that game and Triple Deluxe, in terms of though they have those very robust move sets for the powers. And, you know, you can experiment with them and just have fun with them. Do you need to use them desperately much to just get through a level oftentimes? No, but it's fun to use them. So it's a similar thing here, just playing around with combining the powers and see what they could do. And yeah, sometimes you'll hit upon a combination that is just absolutely perfect for the situation you're in. And even though it makes it laughably easy, like, for instance, just standing up on a ledge and raining a fire arrow into DDD's face that you can do nothing about, it's still amusing to have lucked into such a perfect combination. And the one thing about them is that very oftentimes there will be a shard, you know, the shards being used quite similarly to star coins and all that kind of stuff that's become a real staple of Nintendo platformers in the years hence. Very often you'll need a particular kind of combination power to unlock one of these things in a level. And it's color-coded, isn't it? There'll be something in the level that's got a stripe or a checker pattern or something like that, that will kind of give away what you need to use. Sometimes it's really incongruous and obvious that's what it is, and other times it's more subtle. Like if you're just coming out of the pyramid and there's some yellow and brown stripes, that's not immediately making you think that that has to be the power-up that combines Spark and Rock, but turns out that it is. Other times there's a giant red and green shield around something, and there isn't a lot of mystery there. And there's even some light puzzle solving at times where, like, there's one where you get this sort of these three holes in the wall that are just black, and then a sequence of buttons afterwards. But if you bring the right combination of powers, you can actually illuminate what those things are on the wall, then press the correct combination subsequently and get the shard. You know, so it's got a little bit of something going on. It is very much what I thought it was going to be, but I have enjoyed the little flourishes that it provides.
Yeah, the Kirby games from that director pretty much always, Dreamland 3 anyway, has puzzles like that where you might have, like, you're going to enter a level and you're going to see a smiling flower, and then you go to the next screen and there's a ton of flowers, and turns out what that meant was that you're not supposed to step on them. Like, if you don't jump over them, then you're going to hurt them. No. And at the end of the level, you're going to be denied the special thing that you were supposed to get. So there's weird stuff like that. And this is another... I wouldn't trade personally the quickness of the other Kirby games for these puzzles, but they're a nice thing to have. Like, they're certainly different.
The thing is, I mean, obviously, Kirby games like Dreamland 2, for instance, on Game Boy, you know, it's kind of natural that it's going to be slow, a little bit like we talked about Pokemon Pinball, because you've got a low resolution environment, but you've got these, you know, nicely drawn cutesy sprites, especially like that one had the animal friends and all that. You know. So it needs to be, you know, endearing the way it looks, so you know, it makes sense that it would be that way, and then you have to kind of slow down the pace of the gameplay accordingly. With this game, you know, you're using polygonal graphics, so you can dynamically change the perspective and all kinds of things. You know, you can pretty much do what you want, but oftentimes it is really quite close in on Kirby. And so it has this, it really does have to have this kind of slow pace. I don't know how much of that was technical or creative decision, but yeah, I'm not a huge fan. With hard games, I'm perfectly content for them to be excruciatingly slow and deliberate, like Ghouls and Ghosts, because it just makes sense to me that with a hard game, you want to take your time and be really rigorous about it. With easy games, I like them to be fast and fluid and just a joy to kind of run around, because you know the actual sort of challenge of it is not really the point.
Right.
So I definitely concur on the pacing point. But I mean, the graphics were not as bad as I was expecting.
They were quite good. I mean, the geometry... Yeah, the geometry is so simple. I don't think the enemies have texture on them, but they don't need it. You know, it's all primary colors.
Of it is kind of flat shaded. Or where you've got textures in the environments, they tend to be like, rather than go for detail or anything, they tend to be patterned. You know, like jigsaws and tablecloths and this kind of thing. So the kind of limited ability of the N64 to do good, it just doesn't really affect it. And of course, the biggest thing is, on the Wii U Virtual Console, you have the fact that it's, you know, it's big, it's running at 480p 1080p instead of, you know, what, 240, which is the N64's native resolution, and of just the quality of the output through HDMI. Right. Is so much better than it would have been through the composite or, God forbid, RF back in the day.
Yeah.
That, you know, that very clean, bright style, I think, is well chosen for what the N64 could do. But the problem is, color bleed just ruins it with old school, you know, display technology.
Right.
It just, what was a very clean and stark image becomes a mess. When you're playing through on composite or something like that, play it through HDMI now, it retains that starkness, and it is definitely more attractive than I was expecting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Guy.
Yes.
What do you got?
I'm kind of mired in a long RPG that I'm not ready to talk about. Okay. So I was desperately scrambling to find something Nintendo-related to talk about. And this week, this month, one of the free PSN games that came out is Castle Storm, a game that's also available on the Wii U. So I checked that out. And it's this game by Zen Studios, the makers of Zen Pinball. But it's basically, I don't know, Angry Birds meets Swords and Soldier, that WiiWare game. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of side-scrolling real-time strategy.
Yeah, I think I downloaded that for less than £1 at one point, and I have not really played it since.
Oh, it's good job, it's Greg. Quite possible. I think it's been on sale because it came out on the Wii U in December 2013 in North America. So, yeah, it's not new. But so I started out on the PSN version, and I saw that there was some co-op stuff available, but unfortunately, what it would do was split the screen in two in a very weird way, like horizontally, right? And you couldn't see anything that was going on. So I was trying to play that with Karen, and I thought, oh, well, fuck it. You know, I'm going to get this on Wii U. And as expected, on the Wii U, one person can play on the gamepad and the other person can play on the big screen. So if you need a reason to upgrade, that's already a big improvement. And there's also the fact that generally in the Wii U, it runs a little bit better than on the PlayStation 3, smaller load times and stuff like that. But the game itself, I mean, it's pretty fun. It's kind of, but it's fun in a time-wasty kind of way, you know, like, unless people really spend afternoons playing Tower Defense or Angry Birds or whatever, like it's more like, well, you know, I've got maybe half an hour to kill. I'll play a short game like that. And so Castle Storm is more similar to that. It fits more that that bill, you know. And yeah, so you've got a castle first that you're trying to defend from incoming troops and from the opposite castle. Which, just like you, has a ballista that and they're chucking rocks at you or whatever. And so you're chucking rocks back, or you're sending arrows at the enemy, at the troops that are coming towards you. And so that's the Angry Birds part. You know, you're aiming with the joystick, and you're pressing A to shoot your projectiles, and you can select with L and R different types of projectile that are going to be, you know, there's, you know, they've got longer cooldowns the more powerful they are. So you can send arrows pretty quickly all the time, but if you want to send an exploding apple for some reason, then you're going to have to wait like maybe like 20 seconds. And then you check that at the bunch of enemy troops or at the opposite castle. And if you make it crumble, or then you win. There's more to it than that. There's more than the Angry Birds aspect, because as I said, they've got troops that they send your way. You can also create your troops. So you press the X button, and again, with L and R, you can select soldiers or archers or, you know, mounted units. So there's kind of that element of real-time strategy. So that's why I drew the comparison to Swords and Soldier earlier. And in addition to that, you've also got spells. So if you press the Y button, then you can perhaps heal your troops, make them invincible for a little bit. You can also kill, you know, you've got some offensive spells. And you can also summon a hero that you then take direct control of, and he can just mow down the enemy troops, and you know, you control it. It's very simple. He's got like a, you can swing a sword, you can shoot arrows, and you've got the special move, and that's basically it. So it's a lot of things to do at the same time, and so it becomes a real it takes a while to get used to the fact that you're trying to do these, basically these three things at the same time, or trying to gauge, okay, so I managed to clear the troops on the ground, so now's the time to focus on the castle, and, you try to manage your time that way between the different things that you can do. I think that there is a campaign mode. I think it does a good job of easing you into the game. If you try to jump into skirmish immediately, then it's impossible because, I don't know, like,
there's too much going on.
The AI, yeah, there's too much going on. The AI knows what it's doing and you don't. So I think I'm going to wait a little bit more before I get into it. And also there's kind of an upgrade aspect of it that I think I need to spend some money, some time on before I can really measure up to the skirmish AI. Because as you complete missions, you earn coins, and then you spend that to level up your troops, level up your hero, level up your spell or your castle, and get various bonuses. So, I don't know. There's a lot going on. And as I said, it's kind of a more of a time killer kind of thing. You can just pick it up and play it for a bit and earn some coins. And then next time, like if a mission stumped you, you go back, you grind for coins at some earlier place, and then you can tackle it again. And, it's a very, you know, like it's a lot to wrap your head around, but it's also kind of casual that way, you know?
Yeah. It feels like a game, and I don't say this derisively, that comes from a mobile space.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there is a mobile version also, although I think that it's slightly different and might be a little bit, maybe fewer features or things to do.
And games like this existed before the mobile space, and there's one that's on the tip of my tongue I just can't think of that sounds exactly like what you're describing, even down to there being a hero that you control directly. But it does seem like something that would work really well, say, on the gamepad.
Oh, yeah. And it does. Although they don't really use the touchscreen very much. That's one of the things I wish they had done, you know?
Yeah.
When you're playing single player on the TV, I wish that instead of duplicating that screen on the gamepad, instead they gave you basically quick access touch buttons to the spells and to the troops. So that kind of PC RTS style, you could just have like your fingers, like just, you know, you just touch immediately what you want while you're also doing the Angry Birds thing.
Right.
You know, the game has a lot of writing, a lot of quote unquote personality, but it's not really doing it for me. Like the art style is very much lifted from World of Warcraft. You know, like the cartoony fantasy units or I don't know. Like, I'm not going to say they plagiarized, but it's very, very similar. And the writing is not my thing. It's trying to be funny, but they got arrows in the knee jokes in there. And
Yeah,
so it's dated. It was never really that funny in the first place. And most of the time it goes for the lowest common denominator thing. You know, for instance, there's a mission where they you can't use your troops. Why? Because they're all... apparently you misjudge the need for latrines. And they're all waiting, like they're, you know, for the one guy to get out of there. So, you know, they're unusable for the time. And the mission is called the Call to Privy.
And, all right, that's not like, bad. I'm gonna give it that one.
But I don't know. Like, you see, like the intro scene is just like you see a whole line of guys farting and holding it in, and it's just really.
You know, I'm gonna give it a little bit there. I mean, it's not
okay.
It's not the best, but like okay, there's some degree of creative wordplay there.
Yeah, and just to end on this note, because this game reminded me of Swords and Soldier. I realized, oh wait, I bought Sword and Soldier on Wii U back when it was cheap, so and I never touched it. So I went back and revisited that, and boy, it's a lot more, I don't know, it's a little bit more racist than I remembered. back when I played it and we were.
I'm not sure
if the Chinese caricatures really fly today, or maybe I'm just, I don't know. I don't have a whole lot to say about it. I think it's not quite as good as I remembered. Like, I remember mostly on WiiWare, like, I think one of the things that made it successful was that it had probably some of the highest production values that you could see on the platform.
On WiiWare, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like, it had these beautiful hand-drawn sprites, and I think that was very appealing. Nowadays, it's a little bit less, you know, of a... It doesn't make the game stand out as much from other downloadable games.
The production value on the download space has increased significantly.
Absolutely.
And also decreased significantly at the same time.
Yeah. And the gameplay itself, I mean, mostly I feel like you're just in a race to create the most resources as fast as you can and create the most units as fast as you can. And it really feels like you're brute forcing these levels, not really using strategy.
I mean, John's probably going to protest here, but that's most RTSs. Like, that goes back to early PC RTSs of just, like, I need to control all of the doodad that builds units.
Right, but the game is way simplified, you know. It was, like, 2D side-scrolling, and there is a hard cap of like 10 gathering units, and so it's not like you create new bases and stuff like that. It's really just you're on the left side of the screen, the enemy is on the right side, and you go meet it halfway, you know.
It's like dueling tower units. Defenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. And I don't feel like I'm using a lot of strategy, and it's just not that satisfying. So
fair enough.
I'm gonna say pass on it. Castle Storm is more involved and more fun.
All right, fair enough. So that's gonna do it for new business this week. Up next, after the jump, which in John and I will do something terrible in about 3 days, we've got the Thunder Round.
Lords of Thunder.
Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview, Super Mario Maker on Wii U by Don Koopman. Are you hungry? Well, step up to the table and grab a plate for the game that the Koop calls, quote, a feast of recognition. Herr Koopster gives us his take on Mario Maker, and after an extended hands-on time with it, offers a bountiful cornucopia of information. And unlike Neil, he's not a hater. More about that later?
Yep.
Is that a tease?
Yep.
We also have a preview. Pokken Tournament Arcade by Alex Kulafi. Alex hits the 2015 Pokemon World Championships and plays the arcade version of Bamco's upcoming 3D fighter Pokken Tournament. It fulfills his dreams, but our one request here at RFN is a tournament mode that disables everything fun, stripping the game down to its bare, lifeless essentials, as the Poke God intended.
Indeed. And we have a review of The Bridge for Wii U by Brian Rose. It's not just a song by MC Shan anymore. Brian gives us his take on The Bridge, a mysterious puzzle game featuring a quote-unquote older gentleman traversing a somber world with not much to guide him. In other words, my autobiography.
Boom.
And we have an editorial by Neil Ronahan. Super Mario Maker's slow unlocking feels more frustrating than fun. Neil is a man with needs. He has to get shit done. Time is of the essence. In this editorial, he rails against the Mario Man, keeping him Mario down, trickling out the tools in Mario Maker over an excruciating 10-day period. Agree? Disagree? Let him know in the comments.
Especially if you disagree. Especially.
Definitely. And there's... There's quite a few people that have taken the task for that.
And the more loudly you disagree, the more I want you to put us in the comments.
Yeah.
All that and more flame lighting is available to you in our comment section on NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back. It's time for the Thunder Round. If you're new to the show, or if you just missed the one time we felt the need to explain the Thunder Round, because it's fairly self-explanatory. The idea of the Thunder Round is that these are emails that maybe don't rise to the occasion of a 20-minute explanation on why Square Enix doesn't bring over their DS games to 3DS. Because, you know, sometimes that needs its own space to breathe. These are questions that we should be able to answer quickly, which is sort of like the opposite of what RFN is ever capable of.
We should.
Right. And it's not called Lightning Round, it's called Thunder Round, because this podcast has a strange fascination with Lords of Thunder.
It does. It's not a strange fascination, it's an appropriate fascination.
Exactly. It's an appropriate level of fascination.
The full title of the segment is Nintendo World Report presents a radio-free Nintendo production of the Lords of Thunder Round. And then an unknown number of trademarks follows that phrase.
I like to think that when people write the email, it's the lightning, and then this is the thunder.
That's true. They were the flash. Ooh. We bring the thunder. And we're going to bring the thunder right now. Our goal, I don't know that we're going to accomplish it, but our goal, I'm going to call it out right now, is to get through 11 questions in an hour.
All right.
Can we do it? Probably not. But we're going to go in email order. So that means, John, you've got the first email. Go!
Dan from Canada writes, hey guys.
Not the first email.
God damn it. Okay, listener mail. All right, Austin, Brood Wars Park and Nintendo Free Radio writes, it feels like Nintendo's been obsessed with catering to 8-bit era nostalgia for at least 10 to 15 years now. Are we ever going to see them obsessed with catering to nostalgia for an era that was actually good, like the 16-bit Super NES era?
Oh, so, it's a hot take, that is.
That's what we brought you in for, Leahy.
Actually, I wasn't sure what he was talking about, because I think that recently Nintendo has mostly been... I thought he was talking about the library, like the games that are coming out, and really what we're seeing is mostly updates on design that come from the N64 era. Or, you know, if we're talking about 2D games, then Donkey Kong Country, you know, came out. Link Between Worlds is, definitely more based on Link to the Past than the NES Zelda games. And I guess New Super Mario Brothers is the one franchise that goes back to the NES, but then they introduced Yoshi in the Wii version. So, I don't know. Like, I at first I was like, well, Austin is completely wrong, but then maybe he means the way that Nintendo is kind of... all their UI stuff, or when they come up with stuff like NES Remix, you know, or on the Wii Shop, it was the Super Mario NES sprite and not the Super Mario World sprite that was popping up and hitting coin boxes, or games like Pictobits, like they don't involve SNES sprites, but NES sprites. They always go back to freaking Balloon Fight and Excitebike.
Well,
and,
I mean,
and
that's
stuff like
that's.
That.
That's Nintendo at their most iconic era.
It was the start of it all. It's part of
right.
it.
Everything was built on top of it. So,
and just the fact it was the glory. Maybe there's a little bit of like wistfulness about the fact that it was like the last time the Japanese economy was doing well or something. I don't know.
Oh, jeez.
I don't know much of it that kind
it
of
made
fact.
It to the mid-90s. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the 16-bit stuff, if you were to boil it down, it just kind of becomes 8-bit stuff anyways. Like, the appeal of it is mostly
and maybe
in
they
the
think
stuff.
The distinction in some people's minds is not that great, so they'd rather just go all the way back to kind of make to make it more clear. But I mean, I understand what Austin's saying from the point of view that, you know, 10 years ago you had the Famicom minis or the NES classics on GBA or the 20th anniversary Mario Game Boy Micro, and it's got the, you know, the little Mario sprite on it. And then 10 years later with Mario Maker, you know, they've got multiple styles in there.
And
but,
what are they packing in? An 8-bit amiibo.
But the kind of front and center for the 30th anniversary is 8-bit Mario again. But
it's the 30th anniversary of that game, though.
But one thing that sort of gums up the works with this as well is the fact that Super Nintendo had a second life before NES had a second life, which was the GBA.
That's true. Yeah, it was pretty much a handheld Super NES.
Like, the GBA had so many callbacks to Super Nintendo stuff that, like, but then, you know, they didn't sort of cycle back around to the Famicom Mini stuff until the end of the GBA. So, in fact, the start of the DS's life, that was, well, 2005. So, that kind of gummed up the cycle a little bit. I don't know whether that's partially responsible.
But the fact is that NES was more popular than SNES, and Famicom was incredibly more popular than Super Famicom.
Yeah, it goes back to that economy thing again.
And Japan, there you go.
The one last thing I'd say, though, is that the NES is the system that the most, or I would say the vast majority of the iconic games for us are probably Nintendo published. Like, there are the Capcoms and the Konami games, but big portion of the games that we think of as, you know, icons of that platform are from Nintendo. The Super Nintendo, it actually starts to shift towards third parties, because they dominated the third parties in a way, and the third party quality had increased because companies like LGN had finally fucking died. I think a lot of the nostalgia for that platform is outside of Nintendo's ability to push without the involvement of another company. And that limits their capacity to do it.
I think if we could have a few things like a Super NES remix, and maybe like, think about, like, you had Mega Man 9 and 10, you didn't have a Mega Man X equivalent.
You did not.
It's just, if you'd had stuff, I think it's that kind of stuff that leads to this sentiment, and I still want that stuff, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Next email?
Yeah, sure. Next email.
Dan from Canada writes, "Hey guys, I recently finished playing Captain Toad for 90% of the way through the game. I realized that Toad could run. I must not have paid attention during the first stages, when they might have explained the controls. This got me thinking, and I'm sure it's happened to you guys before, where you played a game without a key piece of knowledge which would have made the game simpler or easier. I can think of one additional example that was much worse than Captain Toad, Wind Waker, where I obtained the sail but never thought to equip it. Ridiculous, I know. So I played the first half of the game, tugboating along, probably why I don't have the fondest memories of the game. Though I did love the HD remake with the Swift Sail."
That must have been some sort of quantum leap.
Yeah,
from
seriously.
Nothing to the Swift Sail War.
Yeah, seriously.
"If you can't think of any examples, are there times when you did not collect something or complete a task, etc., throughout the game that you needed in order to 100% or finish the story? Love the show and looking forward to any examples you guys have. Hopefully I'm not the only one who's occasionally terrible at video games."
I pushed for this email to be read, and I'm not sure if I'm the only one who has answers.
You're not.
Okay, but good.
Go first.
Well, so one of the biggest idiotic things that I did was I had never played Symphony of the Night, Castlevania Symphony of the Night on the PlayStation 1. So when I played Circle of the Moon, I guess I understood the Metroidvania part of it. But in Metroid, usually you get power-ups and you don't necessarily change the environment. So there's an area where there's water, and it's poisoned, and you take damage from being in the water. And I had no idea that that meant that I was supposed to turn back and kill a boss to get some amulet or something to clear up the water. And instead, I grinded and leveled up until I could get through the level taking damage in the water.
Wow.
So,
God,
very good. That, I felt pretty stupid.
That hurts.
I've actually got another Captain Toad one.
Oh, really?
It's not as severe as that, but it's what it is. You can run with one of the shoulder buttons in that, as well as the face buttons. And what that does is it makes it easier to adjust the camera. I did not realize this until I was doing that silly challenge at the end for the Golden Crown. That's if I, and it's like, God, yeah, I'm doing some sort of Monster Hunter PSP claw thingy here to adjust the camera while running around, like, away from boozers, and this can't be right. There's got to be something better. And then it's like, yeah, it'd be good if it was on the shoulder. It is on the shoulder, but oh, God damn it. God.
Nice.
The little bit, I mean, really not a core function of the game, like just being able to run at all, but yeah, I felt pretty silly.
John?
I can't really think of one offhand. I mean, I know in some games where I've just like haven't found a tab or something, and that was actually where I added like stuff to my character to do, like, you know.
Oh yeah, like equip items.
Yeah, like stuff like that, where I didn't even realize that the tab was even there, or I didn't think it was, or I thought it did something that was completely different.
Remember when you made the horrible mistake of playing Mario 3 on the 3DS instead of something?
Yes. Good lord.
All right, I've got two. They'll be real quick. 1989, I was born in 86. 89, I received because my parents are fucking monsters.
Already making excuses.
Where in time is Carmen Sandiego for the NES, which comes with an encyclopedia? I did not consult the encyclopedia because I was like 3 and then 4 as I was playing this game and thought, this game really expects you to know an unfair amount about history.
That's amazing.
So, to be fair, I beat that game multiple times as like 4 and 5 without consulting the encyclopedia. And it wasn't until I was cleaning up when we moved when I was like 10 and I went, oh, really? Is that what this is for? And then, sure enough, I put it back in there, and there's actually explicit page references at the bottom of the screen. I'm like, oh, damn. But I learned a lot about history through failure. So thanks, oh, Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego. The other one is way back my first time playing Ogre Battle 64 before I became the world's foremost expert on it. I didn't realize until, like, chapter, I don't know, 10 or 11, that you can revive fallen characters and just let them turn into zombies. And if you were with us when we did the retroactive for that, that's a pretty big loss to lose, like, a major character who has incredible power and turn them into a good-for-nothing zombie and not realize, oh, I only had to pay, like, 500 gold to fix this problem. Shit. So that was my first aborted playthrough of that game.
I've got a couple more. In Link's Awakening, there's a, and people know this, this is a known glitch. You can basically teleport as you move from one screen to the next if you do a certain thing. I can't remember what, but you can teleport throughout the world. And I must have done it by accident when I was a kid. And so I ended up in a dungeon that I was not ready for. And, you know, like, it's not really, I don't know. It's
you got housed.
Yeah, basically. And the same thing happened to me in Final Fantasy Adventure, which is the same kind of game, but it also has like this grinding element. And I don't think I ever figured out that something had happened. Like I just thought as a kid, oh, this game just got incredibly hard. And I think I just powered through it.
Nice. Yep. Any others?
Well, as a kid, generally, like when you gave me RPGs and I did not read English, the whole game was one long thing where I couldn't find the right button, right? Like, I had no idea what I was doing.
Speaking of making excuses, God.
Mm-hmm. the only other one I can think of is a little bit, there's an obvious reason for it, is the whole cheese bridge thing in Super Mario World. It never occurred to me to jump off Yoshi, because that's evil.
Oh, it is. Okay. All right, next email.
Okay, so McVerdy writes, this is a specific question for Guillaume. We all know how much he loves sports in general, so what does Guillaume think about the Pan American Games Toronto 2015 or the last FIFA Women's World Cup? Does Canada make a good host, or are there any signs of corruption in these events?
Wow. Well, I had to, I care
FIFA
so much about
FIFA corruption?
Sports.
Surely not.
Surely.
Well,
just
in the Pan American Toronto games, there was actually a scandal involving a former premier of Ontario, like a sexual harassment case. So,
good.
There's that. I mean, that's a form of corruption. And, I don't really have any thoughts about who, no one has really any thoughts about the Pan American games, as far as I know.
Bills receiver Marquise Goodwin took part in it.
There you go.
Really? That's not a thought. It's a bit of trivia.
It's a fact.
Canada was very successful in it, weren't they? Weren't they really successful?
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, the U.S. didn't send their best people, so
they sent
all
like,
the medals. They've
spent people that are like fifth string receiver on the Bills.
Yeah.
To be fair, he did compete in the Olympics in London as well.
I was in Toronto in the lead up to the Pan American Games, and I felt like there had to be some signs of corruption because there'd be whole sections of major Toronto malls devoted to this that were completely devoid of customers, and yet were just filled to the brim with $35 Pachi plushes that were 10 inches tall.
Oh, wow.
I presumed they must be filled with cocaine. Because that's the only explanation I can come up with for the pricing structure when there were literally zero customers.
So, next question?
Next question.
Ben writes, I was listening to James talk about another code/trace memory on the show a couple of weeks ago, and it got me thinking. For the last few years, when I'm on a holiday or vacation, I've been playing games like this on the DS. As you mentioned, there are a lot of them. I've played through both Hotel Dusk games, Ghost Trick, and even the Leyden games, if you count them. What I want to ask you is, what's next? I'm interested in Phoenix Wright. But then there are games like Trace Memory, Lost in Blue, or even 999. I tried Flower, Sun, and Rain.
Oh, God.
A Suda 51 joint. And frankly, I deserve a medal just for sitting through the opening of that. Any suggestions would be great.
Flower, Sun, and Rain on the DS is an abomination.
I played through most of it. It's not good. Have a FAQ ready, because, oh my god.
So just as a quick aside, even though this is the Thunder Round, we're holding time pretty well, so I can say this one. Nick DeMola was on staff when that game came out and reviewed it. And the email thread of him just losing his mind on this game was all the entertainment Goichi Suda would ever provide me. Like, eclipsed everything he ever did for me as a game creator. Just sheer animosity towards that man as he tried to get through this game for review. So I would guess, I mean, this is sort of in my wheelhouse a little bit, so I guess I'll take the first shot here.
Sure.
I'm a sucker for the Phoenix Wright Saga. I mean, just complete over the moon with it.
Make that your priority.
I love those games. I love them. They are unbelievable. Now, they have problems. Namely, the second game. That's the problems with that series. But you got to get through it because the last case is possibly the best case in the series, which is frustrating to think about. You know, I haven't played Lost in Blue, but Trace Memory, I thought that was really fun. You can beat Trace Memory in a sitting. I did that. I beat it. I played half of it before we recorded the podcast. I talked about it. And then afterwards, before I went to bed, I played the second half. And I beat the game. Like, it's not a big game. You can beat it in a day. It's easy. 999 and its sequel on the 3DS, and its now announced second sequel on 3DS, are amazing. Like, I love those games. Zero Escape via VLR, Virtue's Last Reward, and then Zero Escape 3. Those games are dark, and they've got elements of visual novels much heavier in there, where there's lots of different paths you have to kind of work through. There's a whole kind of meta mystery to those games, but they are their own thing, and they exist solely around themselves, and they are fantastic for it. But they are, you know, they're not the flashiest games in the world from a presentational standpoint, but they're a lot of fun.
So yeah, I'm a big fan of Phoenix Wright 2. Personally, in my touch and point and click.
I've never heard anybody. Oh, 2. Also, I thought you meant the second game.
No, I'm just...
I was going to say, no one's ever said that phrase.
No. 1, 3, and 5, I guess? Like the 3DS one?
Yeah, 1, 3, and 5 are really good.
But yeah, like for me, point-and-click adventure games need to be funny for me to stick with them. I'm not really into the more serious stuff. I don't play them for the puzzles as much as I do for the characters and the dialogue. So Touch Detective...
Oh yeah, and its sequel
is really weird, and I've never played the sequel. But,
oh, it's good.
The first one is really good, and we talked about it on episode 307. Don't let your kids huff the warm mushroom cookies.
Nice.
So that's a reference to a puzzle in there, and yeah, that's the kind of game that you're dealing.
Oh, those games are amazing. I really truly enjoy both of those games, and the fact that all it's spawned out now is Japan's weird fetishization of her mushroom sidekick.
Fungi or...
Fun guy. Because he's a fun guy.
I see.
Makes me laugh every time.
And another suggestion, there is a Broken Sword remake on the DS. And those games have good dialogue. Like, they're well-written.
Oh, yeah.
And really enjoyable. So if you can find that, also check it out.
I'm trying to think of anything else on the DS
I can't think of anything. I'm didn't hit the list here.
I mean that will keep you for a while.
I think so.
If you're looking for something with a little bit more dexterity skills, there's obviously the the surgery games. I'm blanking on what they're called.
Trauma Center.
Yeah. Or Trauma Team and Trauma Center. Yeah. Trauma Center on the DS. Those have kind of the same vibe as these games, although they play quite differently.
They do. I'm not sure if it's really, like, you can... I don't know if you can compare them. Like, they're so demanding.
There's definitely, like, a presentational link there in how those games sort of present their characters and story and, you know, how they move. It's just the gameplay is so different. But if you somehow manage to complete all of these, then, yeah, go knock yourself out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Trauma Team on the Wii definitely, like, it has flat-out adventure, point-and-click adventure segments.
Oh, yeah.
So check that out.
That game's unbelievable. And maybe will one day be downloadable.
It is in Japan, but
fingers crossed.
Everything's downloadable in
what
Japan.
What kind of indicator that really?
Well, and, yeah, and he says he'd have to import 999, which leads me to believe he would be in Europe, which would mean that he'd also have to import Trauma Team.
Hence the reason for referring to it as another code / trace memory.
Yep. It's next email.
So, yep.
Watanuki writes, I have a question about the podcast. I'm curious about how the season changes work. Are they decided by the changes in the show, such as someone leaving or a change in format, or is there a set number of episodes in each season? Or is this something else altogether? Love the podcast and hope it goes for another 10 years.
Executive
James,
fiat.
Explain this intense process.
To be fair, once George R. R. Martin explains it to us, we'll explain it to you. Why the seasons are as irregular as they are.
We decided, so season 4 started, did not start immediately when Guillaume came on, did it?
No.
Season 3 started like 108 episodes
after I joined.
Yes. Season 3 rumbled on. Season 3 made sense because it was when we blew up the cast of the show.
No, it was, mm-hmm. That was 2.
That was 2, then what was 3?
So you don't even know, they don't make any sense, that's it, there is no logic to
did
it.
Did we just wake up one day and say, now we're in season 3?
Yeah, basically.
We do it. We we do it by feel, really. We're like, well, something has changed, so...
Season 5, there probably was a change in music. No, because it was
not
an unusual
always.
Amount of nose harmonica.
Not always a change. There's no hard and fast. Sometimes it's been precipitated by something in particular. Other times, just stick your finger in the air and whatever.
So 2 and 5 are actually the most predictable season changes.
Those made sense. Yeah.
We changed to 5 last week, and I don't remember if we decided during recording or in an email hours beforehand. But like we were discussing it in the lead ups. Like, is this season 5? Do we call this season 5?
We could call it 5.0 if you want to.
No, this isn't a WoW expansion, John.
I'm just saying,
John, you could be in charge of the patch notes.
If seasons are throwing people, you know, we could always go that way. You know, Lord knows there's plenty of stuff to be fixed with James. I'll drop the patch notes. No problem.
Thanks for that. Next email. Drew writes, I'm wondering if any of you are looking forward to a game this fall that's not received a lot of mainstream press coverage. Despite its terrible name, Legend of Legacy looks really promising based on the pedigree of the developers behind it. I've heard very little about this game, and I am wondering if any of you are looking forward to something similar. So, real quick, just to promote the site so Neil can't say we don't do it, they've launched this hype meter, which is basically you tell NWR, what you're excited about, and the staff did it as well. And I know Guillaume and I both have Legend of Legacy on that list.
Yeah, it's my number one, actually. I'm a big fan.
I was really shocked by that, actually.
Why?
I was just surprised it was your number one.
Well, I am just a big fan of the games that introduced me to Japanese RPGs were the Final Fantasy Legend games. And those were Saga games back in Japan. And, you know, when they brought them over, they thought that the Final Fantasy name was more marketable. But, they were Saga games, and Legend of Legacy is very much made by people who made the Saga games. So you've got the illustrator that made that's from Saga, and you've also got composers, and I think the game's director as well. So there's a strong Saga feeling, apparently, from this game, and I'm just really looking forward to it. It doesn't look like it's got the best of stories. Atlas has started releasing short trailers, kind of showcasing the 8 different characters that you can pick from. And, one of them is like the girl with amnesia.
I saw that.
That's how they
introduce
her.
You want to advertise that?
I do wonder if it's a little bit knowing though.
It feels like it is. It feels like they know that it's cliche and they're just like, we're just going to go ahead and call her
right.
The girl with amnesia.
They know what they're doing, as it were.
Yeah, but the structure of the game seems cool because you pick a starting hero and you get their side of the story, and then you're meant to play through the game again with a different character, and there's 8 of them, and they're supposedly quite different. And I don't know, it seems interesting.
Greg?
No, I'm actually looking forward to that quite a bit as well, I've got a fair bit out of more sort of classical style RPGs on handhelds. So I ended up finishing Bravely Default. So, Bravely Second.
Finishing?
Oh yeah, all the way.
The Brotherhood.
All the way. It's worth it for the last boss music.
It is a strong statement.
It isn't, but anyway, this seems like a similar kind of. It could be not. You know, I mean, aesthetically, it kind of looks a little bit similar to Bravely Default when I've looked at the videos.
Oh, absolutely, it does.
Guillaume was referencing, but similar sensibilities as well is more the other thing. I think not the kind of game I ever would have played on a console, but 3DS is fine, and I'm happy to report that these sorts of games are actually coming to Europe these days. They're a bit more on a lag, stuff like Etrian Odyssey and Legend of Legacy, but yeah, at least like by, I think, maybe Q1 2016, we will be getting these. So I'm pretty happy about that. But yeah, other than that, a lot of it's the predictable stuff for me, like Star Fox and stuff that's obviously getting covered at the Wazoo. So
yeah, I'm pretty much the same way.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot that we don't know about that's coming out, right?
Right.
Like it's
Well, if they as soon as they say they're going to bring out Picross 3D 2 elsewhere, that's I don't know how much coverage it's going to get, but
I mean, it got a pretty significant little surge of coverage. I was a little bit surprised, to be honest. So you know, it might get some coverage there. Hmm. I'm befuddlingly interested in Project Cross Zone 2, even though I know what I'm getting. And I know I don't want it, but I can't help myself because there are moments in that first game that I have not laughed harder at a game in a long time. Just idiocy that just made me so incredibly happy at such an incredibly marginally put together game. I'm super excited for Legend of Legacy. I'm morbidly curious about Stella Glow, even though I'm worried in the extreme that I won't even be able to talk about it on this show because
is that a pervy RPG?
It might be.
Okay. Maybe.
It's not imminently clear from how they're presenting it. It seems like they may be playing it up a little bit, but they may actually be accurately portraying it. I'm not 100% sure. I'm interested in like LBX, Little Battler Experience, that Nintendo doesn't really seem interested in talking about that much, even though they're publishing it. But, you know, there's a lot of this 3DS stuff that is Popolo Croy Farm Legend. I mean, there's lots of these weird 3DS JRPG things that I spoke about earlier. Like, all the JRPGs now feel like they need a hook. And these all have weird or unique hooks that I'm interested in all of them. But because there's so many, it's hard to cover them, even speaking as a media outlet, because where do you put your attention? I mean, Nintendo doesn't seem to want to talk about the ones they have. But then you've got the other niche third-party publishers, and they're all coming at you with stuff where you're like,
I don't know what to make of this.
Yeah, what are you trying to offer me here? Please go away.
my list is rounded off with Rive by the Tokitori people, except that this time it's a shooter, and it looks really awesome.
Yeah, I played the Nindies at Home thing, the demo of that. It seems promising, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I'm also getting Rodia the Sky Soldier. I pre-ordered it, and
if
it ever comes out, yeah, like it comes with the Wii U version and the Wii version.
Your grandchildren will play that game.
One day.
Did it get delayed again?
It did. Very recently.
God.
I think it was Donald Theriault who joked that... Who's publishing this? Exceed? I think he said they want
Nisa
this.
Nisa.
They want this to be the last Wii game.
Mission already accomplished, guys.
No, actually, awesome. Because Just Dance games
keep
coming out. So,
of course, John, you got anything?
Monster Hunter Cross is what I'm looking forward to. Really,
but that's not this year.
That's way out this year. Yeah, most of the stuff I'm waiting for is like coming out in Japan, but it's like, you know.
Yeah, like there's stuff coming out in Japan that I want.
But... Rhythm Heaven for 3DS, I'm looking forward to that.
Which we may not get this year either. Damn,
yeah,
Nintendo.
It's like, yeah, I'm just kind of like, 3DS is sort of...
Your 3DS in 2016.
Out. Yeah, 3DS 2016 for sure.
Get that tattooed on your forehead there.
Mm-hmm.
Next email.
Okay, Jamie writes, "Hey guys, oftentimes I find myself playing handheld RPGs on DS or 3DS while I'm watching TV."
Yes.
"I find myself not giving the game my full attention because the game might not require it. is a game inherently not as good as another game if the gameplay is more passive? I personally think that these games aren't necessarily worse, just different. Still, I sometimes think, if this game is as good as I think it is, why am I half watching TV right now?
Actually, I see it the other way, personally. Like, if I'm not paying attention fully to the TV show, I'm like, why am I watching this? Do I need to be streaming this shit? And usually I turn it off.
Yeah, I mean, with RPGs, though, I mean, it just goes to show you, like, that genre is notorious for just kind of padding or fluff, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. Dead time, where you're just sitting around, random battles, you know, that kind of stuff. So it probably has a lot to do with the genre more than anything.
Yeah, I don't think it makes the games worse or worse games. I just think that, yeah, like, they require less of your attention. So they make the... It makes yep. them actually... It makes them more playable in situations where you can't give them your full attention. Like, if you're being yep. jostled around in, like, a train or something, and you can't really fully, you know, do exact platforming, well, you might fire up an RPG and play.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no, definitely is a big reason why the portables and RPGs go so well together and all that kind of stuff. It's just that, you know, that portable games tend to be, like, it doesn't have to be in your own home that these sort of distractions come. So it, yeah, makes sense to me. I don't think I mean, some people will just prefer that style of game in general. Yeah, they won't want a, like, super concentration game, you know, something that's really action-based or a rhythm game or something where you really have to lock in. And that's, you know, like I said, that's a matter of taste. That's not a matter of better or worse.
Yeah, I actually really enjoy that kind of game, but I also obviously enjoy the other extreme. And it's a question of, do I want a session game or do I want something fast? Because I can't play, like, I couldn't play Bayonetta for 7 hours. Like, at some point, yeah. your body just can't handle it. And I could totally play, and maybe possibly did play, a certain game about exploring the world for that kind of time. But I had other stuff going, because a lot of times I just set the boat on a path and said, go! And then just, like, had a video playing on my PC on YouTube, just kind of chilling out.
I tell you what's great for playing while half engaged, what's great for watching, sorry, while playing something kind of half engaged, baseball.
Baseball is fantastic.
Yeah, baseball. I've that's the classic sport where you watch it and talk during the whole thing.
I've actually played a baseball game while watching a baseball game. Like that's how deep that goes.
Did they ever blend together in your mind, like the teams?
Yeah, they did. Well, I deliberately had the two teams that I was watching playing each other just to see what would happen. And it was like a sheer mental breakdown at one point. I had both games had the same batter up against the same pitcher. I'm like, nope, can't handle it. We're not gonna pitch for a while. We're gonna let this guy go and then I'm gonna go. But it's just like a different thing. You know, if I'm playing Bayo, if I'm playing Ace Combat, etc., I'm not gonna have anything else going. But if I'm playing a JRPG, you know, when I was playing that's a good example. When I was playing Yakuza 4, I had, you know, YouTube stuff going the whole time because that game is a lot of just idiocy. And, you know, it wasn't anything that I could, if I'd stop paying attention to the video and came back, I would be lost. Like, it was nothing narrative based. But, you know, I would go back to, because occasionally I'd cut up because a guy just like Colonel Sanders wearing a powdered wig would want to fight. And your eyes immediately cut to that and you can't look away. But then once it's done and you're back out playing, you know, gambling your earnings away, then yeah, I don't need to watch this AI that might be the best Mahjong AI ever put on a console beat the crap out of me all the time while I try to lose 100,000 yen. I can go back to watching somebody sell knives on YouTube via a live call-in show. And that's what I did for a while there because it's so mindless and stupid. And occasionally a guy comes up with what looks like a Beretta with the barrel replaced with a knife and you think, okay, I might be asleep right now. I'm not sure.
And to be fair, I think one distinction I'd like to make is that with some games, you know, it's not just like, well, one game plays like this and another kind of game doesn't, because I mean, even with an RPG, there's different aspects to the game. There's different things you could be doing. So it's like, you know, I don't know, something, I mean, I obviously Xenoblade, when I played through it, was on Wii. But so it's available to download in Europe now as a, you know, a downloadable game through the Wii U. But because it had classic controller support originally, you can do off TV play.
Yes.
So, like, if I was playing through that again this way, I think, you know, I would probably, you know, play certain sections of the game, like more, maybe more the narrative sections where you're exploring new places on the big TV screen, taking it all in, the sights, the sounds, whatever. But then, say, for instance, if I just wanted to do more of the side quests that I never really did when I played it on Wii, then the off TV kind of comes into play a lot. So it's not just like the game is all, you know, it might have components that are optional even, you know, they're not really, but yeah, they might have some kind of link into the rest of the game. It's just like, you know what I could do. I'm sure plenty of people will talk about Pokemon cycling back and forth to hatch an egg or something.
Yeah, I mean, like all parts of the game you've already seen. I mean, that's the kind of stuff. You just go back and, you know, throw them on the gamepad and watch something while you're going through it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So it's not just as hard and fast as you know, the genres, but it might be just certain aspects of it. You know, it might be, I don't know. It might be like, oh, I'm going to go back and can play all the levels in Super Mario 3D World with like all the characters. Or so, you know, to get the last achievement or something. Ugh. And, you know, it doesn't really require your full focus. You've beaten those levels before. You've heard the music before.
It's like me with Super Mario 3. I don't really Next email! I have to beat it.
Monsieur Wiener Wink writes,
I was wondering
what you think about what direction the Virtual Console will take when the NX is out. Now, this is really speculative, so please forgive me, but I think we could be looking at a really big future for the Virtual Console depending on what the NX turns out to be. I don't think it's a coincidence that the NX name fits perfectly on a PC desktop or mobile app icon. And it seems to me to be likely that at least some of the games will be playable on those devices. This is where the Virtual Console comes in. Just think of the obscure games that could find a huge audience on a multi-device NX platform that would be well-suited to mobile or PC. Snatcher, Tube Slider, the legendary Starfy. The list goes on and on and on. There is some precedent for obscure older games on iOS like Road Avenger and Vay. And obviously, classic games do very well on PC.
So, who wants to guess why I picked this email?
It's because of
what? Tube Slider.
God damn it, James.
So, fun fact, I recently acquired Tube Slider.
Oh, no. That part of the two up for games.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. I really wish they brought Woolly World out in America sooner to prevent
the F-Zero clone that came out a week before F-Zero GX.
Yeah.
Oh, but now it's like an oasis in a desert or whatever, right? Yeah, we'll see about that.
But yeah, I like the idea just of the Virtual Console becoming a platform because, you know, Final Fantasy VII came out on iOS yesterday, and it doesn't seem to be a great port, you know? But it also seems like iOS is the go-to place where people port their classic games, and it's just not very well-suited for it. So I desperately now want Nintendo to come up with some platform that has a gamepad and buttons, you know, that can actually do these games justice. I want Nintendo to make the destination for these types of games.
Yeah, I mean, that would be pretty cool, where if you could install some VC app on your PC, and then they could sell an adapter where you could plug in the original controller and, you know,
Or
play
just
VC
like any
games
regular
on your PC.
Gamepad. Like, I would even play them with a 360 pad. Like,
it's
heresy. Really mind.
Heresy. You shame
but,
yourself.
The problem is Nintendo would have to let go of this idea that their emulator needs to be perfect and needs to be packaged with each and every game. Mm-hmm. I think that perhaps they could be less stringent about that and they would need, I think, to be more proactive in going to third-party publishers and getting their games on there. Because I think one of the biggest things that holds up Virtual Console efforts and just like bringing old games back in general is license problems.
Yeah.
So I think that Nintendo would have to be ready to kind of broker deals or to you know, cut the red tape or whatever. Like, they would need to take charge of that kind of stuff and try to get
I mean, our understanding from what people have said about this is that Nintendo really do, you know, choose even the third-party games to a large extent, don't they? So, I mean, they are doing some of that stuff, in which case they could get a big sloppy wet kiss from me for finally wising up the Demon's Crest.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's a good thing, but they need to do it on such a bigger scale. And the virtual console being on multiple platforms would also help.
Yeah, you know? I think, to be honest, that is essential. I think what is essential to me that the next time we have a virtual console relaunch or whatever, there's at least an implicit promise of it being functional across multiple devices. Well, whether that would include PC or mobile, I don't know, but at least as that, you know, this whole, every virtual console, every console, you know, that Nintendo puts out with respect to retro games is an island unto itself. It's got to stop because the fatigue is getting there now. Where I just don't, I think it's really going to hold back people buying stuff on there when it's just kind of like, oh, well, you know, is this either going to do that well, this platform, and then they're going to release something else and then I'll have another completely discrete virtual console service.
Yeah, you know, it's got to be game for a fifth time.
There's got to be light at the end of that tunnel.
It is
somewhere.
Utterly baffling that there are Wii Virtual Console games that are not out on Wii U. Like, it's frustrating and just upsetting in a lot of ways. Like, you deal with the situation where the game you really want to just port over, because I haven't done any of that yet. I haven't done the file move yet on Wii, because most of the games I would want to play aren't out yet. I just look at them and go, well, I don't really need that. So why? So if they just built a single, so I mean, it goes a little bit to when Iwata was talking about the investor briefing about how they found that having multiple platforms is counterproductive, and building a single development platform essentially makes things easier. So the NX being, as we understand it, the sort of fruition of that sort of discussion to his investors, it seems like that invariably, if they build a platform, singular development environment, even if it's not a singular device or a singular family, it's just a singular set of, you know, software can run on both in some way, then you are able to build essentially indiscrete virtual console libraries where they're essentially everywhere by merit of the fact that that system is, or that the platform is everything. And maybe you have to sandbox off some for power concerns, but if you could get there, and that seems to be where they're trying to get, I think a lot of this problem goes away. And then if every future device is built on the same, at least built in the same way, able to run this stuff, then you don't have to worry about it anymore. Then it's really just up to Nintendo to build an account system, which they've said they're finally really going to focus on doing.
Yeah, they've promised that, and that has been promised that it would integrate with the mobile stuff. So maybe that provides some suggestion of what Monsieur Wiener Wink is talking about. Here.
Well, it's a problem Nintendo needs
long
to get
time
out.
Listener.
It's a problem that Nintendo needs to get out in front of too, because I mean, you're seeing stuff like Rare Replay happen, which I didn't even think was possible. And I just saw that Super Star Wars is coming to the PS4. So
right. Yeah, like they need to kind of affirm their place as the kind of the retro peddler. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. anyway, thunder round.
Next email.
Me? All right. TK writes, hey, fellas. What are your personal rules for giving up on a game without completing it? I find that occasionally I encounter a game that I am not really enjoying, but my stubbornness refuses to let me quit without getting to the end credits. Sometimes the game just isn't fun or has a boss battle that's too hard to beat without hours of grinding. When is it okay to call it quits with your pride still intact?
Oh, your pride never suffers from not finishing a video
drinking.
Game.
That's my red flag.
No,
if I'm
that's
the problem.
You know, my games are never finished. They're just in the backlog. You know?
John, you have never started.
Yeah.
Touché.
No, I mean, Johnny spoke about this plenty of times over the years, and I've always felt pretty similarly. You walk away from it anytime you don't want to do it anymore. You know? I mean, it's just silly. I mean, especially if we're talking about a sort of a boss battle towards the end, where, I mean, you've seen most of the game, is a fact of the matter, and God, I mean, not that this ever was a huge thing for me, but you know, if you just really want to see the ending, like where if that's really easy now, like to see a game ending or just see that little bit that you're missing out on or whatever. So, I mean, I think it's perfectly okay. You know, whenever you feel like it. I don't see why there should be any kind of internalized shame about anything like that. But the stubbornness point I get, because sometimes it's just like, I know I could do this. If I just knuckle down and do it properly, I can do it. It's not that hard. I can do it. And then you proceed to bungle your way through to innumerable failures for the next several hours. Yeah. You know, that can be very annoying. But that's just, unfortunately, when you have this itch somewhere that tells you, like, I can do this, I should be able to do this. Why the bloody hell am I not being able to do this? But,
So the key point here in the email is that it's a game that TK is not really enjoying, right? So to me, like, just ask yourself, what could I be doing right now instead that would be fun? Yeah. And go do that instead. Like, I'm sure that you've got some games on your 3DS or Wii U or whatever that you could switch to and have instantly fun. So do that or watch TV
or
whatever.
Yeah, don't turn your games into a job.
To a certain extent, I mean, I'm the completionist here. And to a certain extent, that challenge is such a tremendous reward when you pull it off. Like, there's such an emotional high. I mean, literally,
it can be if it is a game you enjoy. I find
there is a literal chemical high taking place in your brain when you complete those challenges.
Oh, there is,
but only if you're enjoying the game.
I think that's the difference. Is that I think if you've got to a point where you're just not enjoying the game, but you've disengaged with it, you know what I mean? If it's me like trying to beat some really hard boss battle or something over and over again, like there's a part of that that's not pleasurable, the repetition, the feeling of incompetence.
On some core level, I am still enjoying it.
I'm still enjoying the act of playing the game. It's a game I enjoy. I like the mechanics, the controls, the art, the music, whatever it might be. You know, I mean, if that part of it isn't there and all you've got is the negative feedback, I'm walking away straight away.
To me, the worst is when you have an avenue to beat whatever is your stumbling block, assuming it's a stumbling block, not just I'm tired of this game. And you don't want to use it because you recognize that that's just going to set you up for something worse later. Like that's the absolute worst feedback loop.
So personally, like I've got basically, I call it the bullshit rule. At some point in the game when I'm playing, if I scream out, oh, that's bullshit, then the countdown starts. And if I'm not past the bullshit pretty soon, then I put the game away.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, it's you have to have a stopping point where you're like, okay, this I'm really not enjoying this.
So I'm going to give a quick example.
Especially
we'll
if it's cheap.
And then we'll move on. I'm marathoning through the Metal Gear Solid games because I'd only ever played the first one. Mm-hmm. And I got stuck on the second to last boss, which is fight a bunch of Metal Gears in Metal Gear Solid 2. And I have plenty of health, but I don't want to use it because I know there's another boss right behind it, because of course there is. And like, I died, I don't know, 10 times, and I just got so frustrated because you have to watch this stupid video Kojima masturbatory stuff, or you just have to hammer through a bunch of X's to get through it. And ultimately, I put the game down for like a week and a half because I got so frustrated with it.
Yep.
And like that's what I suggest if it's just a frustration thing. Set it down and come back later.
Yeah, let the wound heal a little
because
bit.
Because you're so irritated right now that you've kind of lost your focus. If it's just I'm bored with this
and you get worse. That's the thing. Just the physical act of playing the game, your proficiency gets worse with the frustration.
Yeah, like I've had that happen before where I've had the same thing where I'm just like, you know, you get progressively irritated to the point where you start making stupid mistakes. You just like
get more irritated and then you make more mistakes and it's the vicious circle. So
and then I've come back, I've walked away, come back 2 days after the fact, come in, beat it either straight away or beat it like the second time through.
But
it helps to sleep on it. Yeah.
If it's just you're bored with the game, like the game is forcing you to repeat the same cycles over and over again to get to the actual end boss, not that that's happened anytime recently, soldier through, because that's what you should definitely do with your time. You should definitely replay
also,
the game.
Also, what I would suggest is you might want to consider, if you're playing the game on 3DS, you might want to consider moving it to Wii U. Just saying.
Don't frustrate yourself with inadequate D-pads. But the last thing I want to say about this is, not only do I not have rules for completing things, a lot of the time I don't even really think about it.
Yeah.
It's automatic.
I will end up kind of walking away from a game without thinking about it very much. Or, I'll stick with it. Like, not because I've sat down and thought, I've really got to beat this thing. You just do. Like, I've never given it that much thought. It's meant to be kind of leisure time, and you just kind of let you go where your impulses take you. I've never had that much in the way of rules for this kind of stuff.
The thing I want to finish on is, while James is the completionist, I'm the guy who gives up on games pretty easily.
John's got you beat. He gives up before he starts them.
No, I always have a typical stopping point, usually, or a single goal, and if I do that, then everything else is gravy.
So my tip would be, check FAQs, if you're really stuck, and if a part is bullshit and you're not enjoying the game anymore, ask other people. There's a good chance other people have played the game. So just go on Twitter, like, ask, is this game getting better? Like, when I gave up on Shin Megami Tensei Soul Hackers, like, Soren was like, yeah, I don't think you're going to enjoy the rest of this game.
It's going to get worse.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, okay, that's good to know. So it was much easier to put the game away then.
Yep. Or like games like, check a guide, go watch. Just go find, like, a Let's Play, like, 10 episodes beyond where you are and see if they're still doing the same shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just skip to a random point. If they're still doing that stuff, go, no, I'm done.
Yeah.
Next email. Actually, I think it's my turn, isn't it?
Yep.
Jed writes, we're almost on pace. Jed writes, hello, RFN crew. I'm sad to hear about Johnny leaving the show, and I wish him the best in future endeavors. I am, however, excited to hear some more James-John banter. We do a whole segment of that, so...
And where are we? Chet Liver? What the fuck?
Well, I mean, you guys haven't referred to
get in line, boys.
You haven't referred to the website as a hellscape recently, so I think you're probably okay. On to the questions. Why is Nintendo using ambiguous first names online versus showing unique usernames that could differentiate the five Joes that are in a match with Splatoon? Google tried to make people use their real names on YouTube, but got a huge backlash and reverted its decision. Will Nintendo push for more transparency in its user base, or go the traditional route of usernames in the future?
Yeah, it's not like you have to. I mean, mine still shows up as Yoshidius.
Yeah, I mean,
because that's your system name, right? When you first logged on to Wii U, that's the name you gave, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's to differentiate the Mii. Is it different to the Mii that's being used? Like, if it's different Nintendo network accounts, NNDs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of gets into the nuances of their stuff. I mean, they really should allow you to opt in and allow you to expose your real name to your friends.
I mean, just change what your name is.
Yeah, you can do that. But just in general, Splatoon has a problem. Like, you do want to differentiate between the five Tommies that you're playing against in Splatoon. So just maybe have, like, the Mii's faces or something. At least maybe that could give you an indication that one of those guys is actually, like, on your friends list or something.
Yeah, you don't even know who's on your friends list.
Yeah, or they could just an indicator that it is someone from your friends list. Like, just like an orange. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the color of the friends. This is all about the orange. So, like, their name has an orange outline or something.
Yeah, I don't. Right. But no, Nintendo's never going to do the Google thing. The Google thing was an attempt to make you use Google Plus, which Google is now murdering in the back. So
yeah,
that's going away.
Yeah,
and I just want to say very quickly that Splatoon showing your Mii's name or whatever has not prevented Slut King from showing up in Splatoon games. So whatever they were attempting, I think Nintendo failed.
King.
Yep.
Are they the king? Let's just leave it there. That's,
I think that
what is
really
their kingdom?
The Sayat King, like uppercase I, and they fooled Nintendo's systems.
Where is their
systems,
I want to know where their kingdom is, though. Like, where is this place? not for any personal reasons. I just need to know.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing I'd like to see them kind of address with NX, though.
With a new account system, which we're supposed to be hearing about this year.
Yep, I'm hoping to address it.
And one other point, Nintendo will never force you to use your real name, because this is the company that took down the ability to share stuff through Swapnote, a thing called Swapnote, because of one thing that happened in Japan.
Yeah, well, other companies have already tried this, and it's failed miserably. Like,
Nintendo is super protective about the privacy of their people, because they're worried about their young user base.
Blizzard tried to do this. They forced everybody to use their real names, and people lost their shit.
Oh, yeah. I used to go watch their forums just catch fire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's just it won't work. Yeah. It just has to be an opt-in.
All right, question number two. What is your favorite game to discuss on the show? Not necessarily the most entertaining to play, but the most entertaining to talk about.
Oh, come on, all of us all at once. Disaster.
Disaster.
Disaster is a favorite. It's
yeah,
a favorite.
Disaster's up there.
Definitely.
Personally, I would choose one of the retroactive games just because it's everyone participates in the discussion. I think Ease Book 1 and 2.
That was fun.
Talked about them on 330, 332. They were really fun to talk about.
Life is a snowplow.
Yeah, like they predate the first Zelda, which just blew my mind. That thing has anime cutscenes, and it's earlier than the NES Zelda. Like, what the hell?
To that point, like, I really enjoyed a Second Ogre Battle reference in one day, but I just enjoyed giving out little bits of information about what that game could do, and hearing the rest of the crew go, "What?"
Or quote unquote little bits of information.
they were little in the grand scheme of what that game has.
He didn't edit a game. I did.
John? Or Greg?
Are you implying that my disaster answer was facetious, James?
I apologize. This is harder than it looks, okay?
Let's see. Mylon Secret Castle?
God damn it, Johnny!
Oh, dear. Mario 3, obviously. It's a big one.
Next email.
All right.
Okay, Carl writes. I'll read it. Carl writes, I've been out of Nintendo products in general for some time now. The last Nintendo systems I owned were the GameCube and the GBA. Recently, I have been seriously debating getting back into Nintendo gaming, wise choice, and decided I'd get the most use out of a handheld system. But with all the options now, with the now cheaper 2DS, the 3DS, the new 3DS, I am not sure which to purchase. Save money with a 2DS or get the new 3DS hotness. Or go with the middle-of-the-road 3DS. Or screw it all and get a Wii U. Thanks for the advice. Keep up the great work on the show.
I vote middle-of-the-road 3DS.
I would go with 3DS XL if you don't have one.
Yeah, that's
the first thing is what we say, if he thinks he'd get more out of a portable, you know, is the portability a really big part of that? Because then maybe you wouldn't necessarily want an XL option if it's about taking it with you and stuff. I like the XL, but I don't really take it with me. It's a home
thing. Yeah, and I mean, 3DS versus Wii U, those are just two. That's apples and oranges. I mean, what are you looking for there?
I would wait to get a Wii U at some point because there's a lot of... Wii U doesn't have a lot of games, but the average quality of its games is phenomenal.
There is
a price drop for that system coming. There has to be.
At this point with Wii U, I mean, you could go in there, you could walk out with like 10 amazing games if you buy a Wii U right now. Top quality, really, really top shelf
like
stuff.
Like nine pluses. And if you wait till that price drop happens, which we got an email about this, I'm going to go ahead and say we're getting 12 emails in by saying this. There will be a price drop this year. There freaking has to be. And then, or early next year.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't think Super Mario Maker is going to push sales the way that previous...
The way that Xenoblade Chronicles X will?
No, but I mean the way that
Mario Kart did.
The way that previous Christmas releases had.
He ain't going to do what Mario Kart did either, which was in the middle of the year.
Right.
I don't think probably like Smash Brothers, I think, was probably
in the next in the next before shift. Now and next E3, there will be a price drop. And you will be able to get a steal of a system for a ton of games.
Sure, but let's be fair. I mean, if you are talking about someone who's been out of the game, the Nintendo game, since GameCube and GBA.
Sure, you have the Wii.
3DS, or 2DS, whatever it would be. You've got all the DS games. This is sitting on a fucking gold mine.
I'm not saying for the Wii U though. You have all of the Wii's library.
Yeah, but DS and 3DS.
But you've
got Mario Galaxy
and Galaxy 2.
Oh yeah, I mean look.
That alone wipes out like 10 DS games.
Well, yeah, but you know, I mean, if portability,
this hellscape, it's a hellscape again.
If portability is the benefit anyway, I think the vastness of the library. Yeah, I mean it's the real top end stuff probably goes to the consoles, but The 3DS and DS have got fantastic libraries. Obviously, fair amount of it kind of duplicative, so you probably just go with the more recent ones. But, you know, as we've seen kind of like with the whole trace memory kind of conversation, there were different kinds of games that came out early on in the DS's life, you know, that emphasized the touchscreen and all this kind of stuff. So there's definitely plenty of variety there. So
now do you think that it would be viable for him to get the 2DS for, and then also
that's even less portable than the XL though?
It's less portable. We don't know if that's his criteria though. If he's just if he wants all the Nintendos.
Yeah, he talks about the price, and that's the thing. Like, if you're really worried about saving money, then get a 2DS, I guess. And the Wii U, you can already, like, you can probably look at sales.
You can buy a refurb from Nintendo.
Yep.
Yeah.
But if price is not really that much of an issue, I'm going to be the one who sticks up for the new 3DS. I think that you're not going to really be opening up a great big avenue for new games. Like, I don't think
there's two of them.
Yeah, exactly.
And one of them's a busted version of Binding of Isaac.
Yeah, but I do think that if you're interested in the 3D effect, I think the experience is so much better. So might as well go with the Cadillac of 3DSs and.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that the 2DS is on the table maybe suggests that's not a huge thing, but I see what you mean. That is probably the thing about the new 3DS, you know, is the enhanced auto stereoscopic effect. I mean, the nub and obviously it's just total dearth of exclusive stuff at the minute. I can't really see that changing a whole lot.
My argument would be, if portability matters, get an original 3DS. If it doesn't matter, don't even think about the XL.
But the original 3DS is a creaky piece of crap hardware.
Yeah, that's where it would be kind of nice if Carl is in North America, then, you know, there isn't the smaller new 3DS as an option, which, is kind of a decent compromise. It's a bit cheaper. And it's a normal size 3DS that doesn't suck as much as the original model, but so
to answer another email we got, I still think it's
import one from somewhere else.
No, we got another email asking, is this thing finally coming with the drop of the 2DS price? 2DS probably isn't selling well. I think it's finally going to happen.
I hope so. Could be. I like that theory.
Yeah.
Just the 2DS being priced down to make space for the regular.
Well, also it makes sense.
It's not easy to find an original 3DS right now.
It could make sense if it's going to be bundled with something that's leveraged on Amiibo a little bit, like the Animal Crossing thing, maybe. Mm. You know, you have some custom face plates to go with it. And because, of course, that is the other thing that the new 3DS has, is inbuilt. And there's a hockey puck add-on coming for the other 2DS, 3DS, all that stuff, but the new ones have it built in, so the cards and all that, so they might want to sort of bundle it together with an Animal Crossing, or I don't know whether they've got anything else coming up that's really that.
So let's go around to answers real quick, just to kind of wrap it up. I vote original 3DS unless portability doesn't matter, then I can justify going the new XL. I think the regular XL is right out because the price difference isn't significant enough.
I like my new 3DS. So
XL specifically.
XL, yes.
John, Greg?
Tough. I mean, I would probably. I can't argue with Greg when he says the DS has a massive ton of games. So I gotta go.
Are you gonna
say
a DS Lite? I'm gonna be mad at you.
No, I'm gonna go. I'm gonna say DSi. No, I would say original 3DS is a good choice now.
Right.
Yeah, tough one to come down on without knowing exactly what he's looking for. 2DS would be a hell of a lot more attractive if it was clamshell.
It would.
I know it's like the cheapest chips, and well, it's not, but you know it's meant to be. And for kids or whatever, but I really dislike that. I think it limits portability, so I can't say that. So I think I'll go with James and say straight up 3DS. But if they had the regular size new 3DS in America, I would say that.
I would say the same too.
Or if you're in a place that has it.
Yeah, or if you're in a place that has it like here.
I.e. not America.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that you guys are crazy. The regular, the first, the original 3DS.
It's really, it's bad, I know.
It is bad.
You have to hold your nose.
It's creaky.
You have to hold your nose when you say it, but that's just the box that NOA's put me in. I don't even live there. So it's not more, don't blame me.
that's going to do it for the Thunder Round. Guess what, guys? If you count the two extra emails we threw in there, we got through 13 emails in an hour.
Nice.
Wow.
That's what we
that
do.
That is an RFN record by like 6 emails.
That's efficiency right there.
We are amazing.
Yeah, we got this shit. This is
We
this,
are amazing.
We got this stuff. We got the ship turned around, guys.
This is how the new regime going to do. Yeah,
this is the way it goes. Just stay out of our way.
James is officially the Chip Kelly of podcast hosts.
That's right.
Our play count is going to wear everybody out.
Yep.
And on that, I'm pretty worn out. So that's going to do it for the show this week. Gentlemen, if you want to hear us answer your question, possibly in a rapid fire setting, maybe
or
not. Or not. Depends on what you send us. You could send your email with your questions to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Also, what you could send to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com is your suggestions for our newest feature of Season 5, which is the end theme for the episode. We're going to end with a classic song from a Nintendo game. Right now, of our choice, but of the future, maybe yours. This week, we're doing Guillaume's choice. We're going to end the show with, from Tetris Attack, the theme of the Wiggler stage in Flower World. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I'm so sorry. If anyone gets like a seizure from the baseline, which I think is possible.
Guillaume did ask if you can get a seizure from sound, and yes, you can trigger seizures from sound. But I feel like if you're sound sensitive for seizures, this show would have already done it. On that note, that's it. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Email about Federation Force.
Damn it! Five.
Hot takes.
Four.
Hot takes.